Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
Shut up! My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soucy.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soucy. The show is available as a podcast. It's also available on iTunes. And like all the podcasts here at WFYI, they are available on Spotify. Hope you are staying safe. Hope you're staying healthy. Hope you're staying sane. And hoping you're seeing a lot of, hopefully some good films while we are in these times of hanging out at home more than usual. Now, before I tell you to grab a pencil, because that's what I've been calling these shows the last several weeks, I actually have an interview that I conducted Friday morning, and I want to share this. I have to give kudos to Simon Majumdar for coming on. I swear I'm going to have him on when it's a good situation. I had him on very quickly last time because of the death of Terry Jones, and, well, we all kind of know where everybody is living at the present moment, so as he jokingly said, he was at home when I called. But here is my epic chat with Simon Majumdar to talk about his podcast, Eat My Globe, which just started its fourth season. So we'll talk a little bit about the show, and then we'll get into movies that we've watched recently and some other titles. So I guess you could grab a pencil during the chat with Simon and I. But I hope you enjoyed this. Enjoy. Simon, how you doing in all this?
I'm doing much better than anticipated. I have to say, you know, I get a little stir crazy. We're in our tiny little apartment here in LA because we're never normally here. We're usually traveling off around the world or around the country. So it's taken a little getting used to, and I've had to come up with a kind of routine where I go out first thing in the morning before too many people are around, and then come home and try and fill my day with writing and, you know, cooking and doing all kinds of stuff, and then catching up with things on the TV, which is hard for me because I hate just being kind of at home. I'm not very good at it, so it's taken a while. But I'm, you know, a lot of people, it's better than the alternative, shall we say.
Yes. So I'm guessing you have a little studio in your apartment to record?
No, I don't. So when we're doing the recording for the podcast, we actually go to a friend who's a producer. They've just moved, so they're relatively close now. They're up in Ventura, so they're close to us. And we managed to get six episodes of the podcast in the can, actually just before we were told we were going to lock down. So those six are in. We're going to be releasing those over. We've just released the first one, so over the next six or so weeks. And then, you know, hopefully we'll be in a situation where we'll be able to go back out. I've written another five or six. I'm in the middle of writing one at the moment. On the history of caviar.
Ooh.
I'm actually giving myself a day off today because I've been staring at the screen and had, you know, what do they call it? It's like someone was saying about Barton Fink, it's the worst horror movie because it's about writer's block.
Yes.
And for any writer, that's like the worst thing. And I just couldn't, in the last two or three days, I've not been able to write more than about 100 words without stopping. So I'm going to give myself a couple of days off because, you know, I'm in no rush.
Right.
So we go up and we record up there. So hopefully we'll be able to get up there. The shame is that we had a couple of interviews that were set that were going to be really fun. We were going to be interviewing Julia Child's nephew about her at an event. And we were going to be setting off to interview Jacques Pepin, and I don't think that's going to be happening anytime soon. So it's a shame. But we're, you know, again, much better than the alternative. And there are a lot, you know, while that's disappointing, there are a lot of people who are out there doing a lot more important things. So it's not the end of the world.
Right. I know people like to use the lemonade analogy. I tend to say making chicken salad out of chicken stuff.
Yeah. I mean, these things are always disappointing, and we've had, obviously, events cancelled or postponed that I was looking forward to and spending time with people. But, you know, there are people out there who are kind of putting themselves in. Interestingly, today, as I was walking around, I saw, three or four people on the other side of the road getting into their cars in their scrubs, obviously getting ready to go off to hospital and be on the front line. So, you know what? I'm just fine. I mean, it's not easy, but I'm fine.
Right. Exactly. A perspective thing.
Yeah.
So you mentioned cooking. I know you just posted a recipe, and we'll get to that. But I wondered, have you been experimenting with recipes, or you've just been cooking stuff that has been comfort food that you can depend on?
No, I've been playing around a lot with recipes. I think it's a good opportunity for me to try. So yesterday, I'd never done knife cut noodles before. It's not something I'm particularly familiar with. So I made some knife cut noodles and just made a homemade chili oil to go with those. And we sampled that. And then I did the recipe that I posted yesterday. I do a few comfort things and a few of my Indian recipes that I post. People seem to like that. And I share those recipes. I haven't really done any kind of live demonstrations because our kitchen is just like a warehouse right now with stuff everywhere, and it's not really suitable to do much of that. And also, I think in terms of those demos, there are lots of amazing chefs out there who are out doing that side of things. So I think people will have plenty of that to look at. I'm just trying to share what we do at home, share some experiences of how we're getting through it, posting pictures of me growing my hair. I haven't shaved my head for 5 weeks or my face, and so I've got the longest amount of hair on my head probably for 25 years. So just, going through it or talking about the cocktail hours that we do, trying to be a little bit disciplined about having drinks here because otherwise it's all too easy. I'm probably about 5 foot away from a very large collection of hard liquor and red wine and white wine. And you've got to be pretty careful not to go too crazy. But a lot of the time it's being in the kitchen is just fun to fill the day, and all those kind of stereotypes that people are doing, like sourdough starters and growing scallions in mason jars of water, or we've got one of those aero garden hydroponic things where my wife is growing salads and herbs and all kinds of stuff. I think it's really interesting. And then the other thing that is actually keeping us going as well is we do some cocktail hours in the evenings where we'll talk to friends and I'll maybe give some classes to them in a very loose sense of making, a few cocktails that I like, and we all do it together and share them. And so, I think there's some positive elements out of this because in an odd way, we're actually more in contact with some people than we are normally. It's just that we're having to do it kind of online. And so we've set it up to do it because we're all at home, whereas often people I meet at speaking events who organize those for me, I don't see them very often. I see them, every couple of months when we're doing an event or whenever it is. And so we've made a determination to kind of catch up with people online. So I think that's another positive that has come out of it.
Yeah, in my neighborhood, I mean, we try when the weather is nice enough, my wife and I, and sometimes our daughter, we'll go out for a walk. And I've seen more neighbors now than in the almost 10 years that we've lived in the subdivision, because we all have the same purpose, is to at least get outside for a little bit while we can, and then have to head back in.
Yeah, I think that's the thing, is that you try and go out, and I think what it's also done is for the main part people are being pretty kind. If I'm walking down the sidewalk and I see someone a distance away and they have a dog and it's harder for them to move out, then I'll move out into the street and let them, so we have our distance. And I think people are being on the whole pretty kind, and is bringing out the best in most people anyway, certainly that I've seen in my kind of brief walks around our neighborhood in the mornings. So I like that, and I think people are trying to help people in, whether it's the restaurant business, who are struggling because they don't have work and all the restaurants are shut, whether it's buying takeout food or whether it's donating to causes. And I think the other, and that's true in lots of industries as well. I know, obviously, you talk a lot about movies, but a lot of cinemas, particularly independent cinemas now, are have looking for donations to support their staff or trying to get subscriptions or are selling passes for when they reopen so they have cash coming in because, it would be a grim thing to come back into any kind of normality without restaurants or all theaters or cinemas and all those things that kind of create the culture that we love so much.
Absolutely. Yeah, we try to do something like that at least 2 to 3 times a week under these circumstances and hope that more people do the same.
Yeah, and I think, at the same time, trying to understand that people are, struggling a bit. I read somewhere the other day that, it's not even a political thing, that most American families are only about $400 away from being in debt at any one time, which is a frighteningly small amount. If you have something happens like a boiler goes or your car is broken or you get ill or, where you're going to incur some costs. So people have got to, balance their budgets first and then hopefully they can get out there and support other parts of the culture as well. But it's, it's a tough time for everybody. We're obviously seeing people who are just out of work right now. I read somewhere it was 20 million people. So you've just got to, realize that people are going to struggle right now and try and be kind to everyone. And, I'm a freelancer like any, a lot of people, if there's no work, there's no money. So we have to manage our own things too. So, you just have to be realistic in this. But I think part of it is, if I was just sitting at home not working because nobody wanted me and everyone was out there doing, amazing things, you would feel worse. But you kind of realize, not in the nicest way, that it's happening to everyone, but you realize it's happening to all of us.
Yeah,
we just need to get through it the best way we can.
I've been deemed essential staff, so I get to come in a couple times a week, and I'll be live on the air on Saturday. And it's not hospital work, but it's a little bit of normality. I think that your podcast is a part of that as well.
Well, I think podcasts, entertainment, the radio, whatever it is that gives someone a contact to sort of a life that seems a long time ago now, 5 weeks ago, the notion of being able to go into a restaurant, and I was trying to remember kind of how it felt. I mean, it all seems so long ago. So just hearing a great voice on the radio or hearing a show that you like and a familiar voice, or even whether it's social media, seeing a tweet from someone or a picture from someone, they're all pretty important because we're trying to maintain a community.
Yep.
And so, and not just nationally but internationally, and I'm lucky that I have people from all over the world who follow me on my social media. And even now I just got a Facebook message from an old work colleague from many moons ago who's in Australia, and it's just, how are you doing, how are you and your wife doing, this is what's happening to us. So that was great. So just being able to keep in touch with people, I think, is really important right now.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us what, as far as your commitments at Food Network, where they stand right now?
Well, I think it's, like anybody else, we're just waiting to see, when people get back into production. So like anybody else, they'll come to me when they know what their schedules is. I think like everybody else right now, they're like all productions, I think, of all everything, they're just hunkering down. They want to make sure that their staff and their talent and their crews and everybody is safe. And that's number one. And then they'll have plans the moment, we all have plans that we can start filtering back in and doing some shows. But I don't think it's going to be a light switch for anyone. I don't think they're suddenly going to switch it on and go, oh, we're all back to normal. I think this is something that's going to take years to work through. We're not all suddenly going to be filling restaurants. We're all going to be a little concerned when we go into workplaces and there's big, congregations of people.
Yep.
Sets are very busy places when you're filming. So they're going to have to think through that. Otherwise, what you get is what you're seeing in China and other places, this resurgence and second waves, and because people suddenly think, whoa, we're free now, and of course you're not. Mm-hmm. So I think, like all of that with movies, TV, you know, the shows I do, they're going to have to be some rethinking of how they film those. You know, those are conversations that I'm sure are going on.
Yeah. So you mentioned you get a, you try to take a walk in the morning. Are you recognized on the street still, even with your hair?
No, I'm too wrapped up. I have a hat on. Okay. I have a mask on. I have, I look like some kind of like robber from the 1920s, a bank robber. So, I mean, even if, unless they could recognize me by my kind of dewy old age eyes, I think they'd probably deserve a prize if they do.
I say, is the hair status, is it Dickensian villain or spaghetti western?
I look like Eli Wallach right now. That tells you everything.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, so I shaved my beard, over a month ago. I had just got done doing a show, The Book of Will, and I still have the hair, but I heard for a while that, you know, you should shave, and Mrs. Sosi appreciates that I have shaved. But, I love the picture, Simon. They look, you know, way to let yourself go.
Well, I've just decided, you know, I never normally get to do this, and I'm usually pretty kind of fastidious about shaving my head and my face, and I feel kind of dirty right now because I've got a big thick beard and the hair, and it's all very salt and pepper, probably more salt than pepper right
yep.
now. But you know, I'm going to give it a go until we come out of this, and then my wife's taking pictures every night, and we'll probably inevitably do one of those time-lapse videos of me going on and then finally shaving it off.
She hasn't given you an ultimatum? She likes it?
Oh, yeah. No. I think she's more enthusiastic about it than I am.
It got to a point when I was in rehearsal for Falstaff, Lynn would have to push my beard under my chin to give me a kiss. So, yeah, not an ultimatum, but a really strong point taken. So, but she also knows it was for the craft. So, all right, let's shift gears and let's talk a little bit about Eat My Globe. I guess the first thing I wanted to ask you is, what champagne goes with fish and chips?
Well, first of all, champagne goes with everything. And it does. I mean, and you can say that from a cultural point of view, in that champagne is wonderful with everything. But I think just the nature of the kind of leesiness. So if you listen to the episode, I talk about the lees, which is the kind of released by the yeast as you're fermenting the wines before, you know, you put them in the bottles and they sit on that lees in the bottle for a while. It gets a kind of a little mustiness, that beautiful smell that you get from a good champagne. And that actually works very well with fish and chips. So what I would say is, and I talk about the different levels of sweetness, the brut and the extra brut and the amount of sugar they add to it during a process called dosage. And I think not to go for the too sweet ones. The big thing for me right now is there's an area of champagne grown called grower champagnes, which is rather than a lot of the big champagne houses, as well as having their own vineyards, buy in a lot of champagne grapes from local winemakers that they've had relationships with now for hundreds of years. But a lot of very small producers who literally just make it on their estate, and they're known as grower champagnes. And that's the biggest kind of area in champagne making right now. And there's some really beautiful ones. They can tend to be a little pricey, but they're really amazing.
Does this? I think champagne, and I'm probably guilty of it as anybody else. It has the stigma of only being used for celebratory reasons or you know, major events. How does somebody break that stigma like me?
Well, I think first of all it's to try it with everything. I mean, I always remember it. I can't remember which one of the. It may be the lady from Bollinger, but one of them saying, you know, I drink it when I'm thirsty and I drink it when I'm not thirsty. I drink it when I'm hungry and I drink it when I'm longing for food. It's kind of, you've got to get used to it. And I think try and find some. One of the things I find is if you go to some of the local you know, big kind of mass stores, the Costco, Sam's, BJ's, those kind. They actually do great deals on champagne that they have there. And they actually, even some of their own branded ones are actually rather good. They're made by some very fine houses. They don't tell you which champagne houses they're made by because I think they have some kind of secrecy with them that they, you know, they don't always want everyone to know which house it comes from. But go and try. I think it's trying them. And I think what happens is we've made this assumption, and it's one of the problems champagne has, not that it has too many because it sells a great amount, but is that people just associate it with a celebration, with a, you know, wedding, a christening, the launch of something. And it's wonderful in those occasions. But it is actually sparkling wines, not just champagne. They're just wonderful wines to be drunk at most occasions. They're a wonderful way to begin a meal. They work beautifully, like sushi works beautifully with champagne. And I think the thing is to try pairing it. Try pairing it with your favorite foods. And the truth is now you can buy, you know, for the price that you would pay for a good bottle of wine, you'll get really good champagnes as well. And just give them a try.
Okay. Muddy Waters has a song called Champagne and Reefer, and it's based on what he liked to have after a show.
Well, that's that. Well, I can say hand on heart that I've only tried one of those. My passions are very much on the sparkling wine side of it.
Now, and I know there's also the history of the actual Champagne region itself. So are you a big stickler on referring to it as sparkling wine / champagne?
Yeah, well, I think you have these demarcations for a reason. So you have these demarcations of origin. And I think it's important to say that, you know, champagne, apart from a few oddities, like there's things called California champagne that they've been making, which is completely different from champagne, but it was something that was they were allowed to call for a while after Prohibition, and it's still in the book somewhere. So you'll see a few people with bottles saying California champagne, but it's definitely not the same. I think it's important for me that things that come from a particular region that specialize in it get preference, or not just preference, but they get recognized. So, you know, there is something amazing about eating proper Parmesan from the region. There is something amazing about eating a cheddar that's made in the West Country of Britain rather than other places. That's not to suggest that there aren't great cheddars, but getting a cheddar from the cheddar region is something very, very special because they've been making it there. There's generations. There's a context to it. There's a history to it. You know, and I think otherwise what you're doing is getting a kind of ersatz version of it. And that's not to say that there aren't wonderful sparkling wines being made all over the world. And there are, and I'm a big fan. There's actually wonderful sparkling wines being made in New Zealand right now, wonderful sparkling wines in other parts of France, and wonderful sparkling wines from Germany. There's a sparkling wine they have there called Sekt, S-E-K-T. Terrific stuff and well worth trying out. But I think they have Prosecco, obviously, is one that has had a slightly iffy reputation recently because they made some fairly bad ones. But now there's a standard again there, and there's some really remarkable Proseccos or Cava from Spain. And I think when you try them, they each have their own place. But I think champagne still holds the position of being kind of the king of the sparkling wines, or the queen of the sparkling wines, I should say, because there's so many women involved in the creation of it. I think it's just something really rather special.
I wonder, so for this particular episode, how much time does it take for you to make an average episode from the time of research to the time you record?
Well, obviously those things can be a little split out. So what I tend to do is sit down in a spare period where I'm not traveling as much, or I'm not, you know, don't have as many speaking events, or if it's between recording shows or whatever, and I'll probably sit and write. It usually takes me about a fortnight, so 2 weeks to record, to research and write each episode. And then that goes to my wife, and she then reads the sites and checks, you know, those sides of it and tells me that my citations aren't terribly good and I should, and she'll find better ones, or she'll change some, you know, just look at it and make sure that my grammar makes sense, make sure it's a good story. Then it goes off to the Department of History at UCLA, and they look at it with a historical point of view. So they look at some of the themes that I put in there, and they get, or even things that are kind of pretty basic. We don't use that word anymore in history. So little things like, you know, I come from a time when we said mankind did this, and they go, well, actually, we've moved away from saying mankind now. It's humankind or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, so small things like that that are look at to the sensitivity of history, the way you refer to indigenous people from a certain place changes quite regularly because of, quite rightly, the sensitivity of how you talk about people and recognize the context about them. And so they point that out. So we make those changes. So it goes to two or three points. And then it's at that point we send it off to my producer. We get together. And we'll then, over about 4 or 5 days, we'll record, you know, 5, 6, 7 episodes. And here's the thing. Each season, I'm very gratified that people do. They come back to me and they go, oh, we'd like to, where are the new episodes? We're looking for the new episode. And I have to kind of remind people that each season is probably more than the equivalent of writing a new book. So it's over 100,000 words per season. And if you put that into context of how long you would take to write a book, which is often a year or 2 years, or particularly with all the research, I'm having to cram it all into a very short space of time. So it's quite hard work. But we'll come up, I think, by the end of this season with the ones that we've written now that we still have to record. We'll be closing in on 50 episodes. So given that we started, you know, 2 years or a year and a half ago, that's not going to be bad.
Mm-hmm. Now, I remember the interview you had with Ken Burns, and he talked about how he had like 7 or 8 different projects going on at once. Are you researching particular food items at a time, or are you just focusing on one particular item?
When I'm writing an episode, I focus on one very much because otherwise I can't focus properly. But I'm constantly looking at new ideas. So I think if you've got to be kind of intellectually curious to want to do this anyway, because you know, we don't monetize this. This is something we do with everyone just as a labor of love. The reason I do this podcast is because much as I absolutely adore doing the television, and I do, I absolutely love doing it, and much as I love doing my speaking events and cooking demos and all of those other things that, you know, get me through life, there wasn't much space and there hasn't been for anything going in depth on these particular subjects. And they're so full of great stories and great history that I wanted to do them. And so, you know, I think I really want to concentrate on, I really want to look for lots of new ideas. So yesterday, as well as kind of trying to write and failing miserably at the writing, I started looking at the history of cookbooks. Because I was wondering, well, what was the earliest cookbook and the first recipes? And so I was thinking of doing an episode on the development of the cookbook, which is actually fascinating. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just looking to see if there's a story there. So while I'm writing or not writing, then if I take a break, I'll go and look at, you know, there were cookbooks that were lost from the Library of Alexandria when it was burned after Julius Caesar kind of raided and accidentally set fire to the Library of Alexandria, and there were a number of cookbooks that were lost by certain people, and we know their names and we see them referenced in other books, but we have no idea what was contained in them. And it's just this fascinating thing that's just out of reach, and I thought that might be worth writing about. Or Apicius, who was the writer of the great Roman cookbook, or the very first recipe ever, which was for a porridge, which was from Mesopotamia from 4,000 years ago, or even cave art where they showed fire and how to cut up, I think it was an ox or something. And there's cave art from 5,000 years ago in, I think it's in part of Africa, but it's cutting up an ox. So it's like the earliest cookbook, earliest recipe almost, of how to cut up and put an animal over fire. And I just find that fascinating. So I'm thinking that'll be the next one. So I'm always thinking ahead what will be the next episode after the one that I'm writing at the moment.
And for those who have not heard, it's called Eat My Globe, and it's online. It's also on your website, simonmagender.com, correct?
Yes. It's actually, I always like to say the full name just because it's Eat My Globe, and it's called Things You Didn't Know About Food.
Yes.
So what we try to do with each episode, and it depends on, and we do interviews as well, as you said, like we did with Ken Burns. But we try and take a subject, often something that we might take for granted, whether it's beer or cheese or chocolate or tea or coffee. We did a great episode on coffee. And try and show you the history of it and try and show you that it's actually really fascinating that, you know, the coffee houses of Britain were like the first political institutions in many ways. So, you know, a lot of the big institutions of Britain now, like Lloyd's of London, came out of coffee houses. A lot of the great gentlemen's clubs came out of coffee houses. And the coffee houses were where a lot of the kind of revolutionary instincts were fermented. And, you know, Charles II rather tried to close them all down. So what we do is in each episode, there's all these interesting things, these interesting people that you talk about. And people don't know it when they're having their morning cup of coffee or they're having mm-hmm. their piece of cheese or they're having a gin and tonic. They don't know these stories about, you know, gin and tonic, probably one of the most popular drinks in the world or alcoholic, you know, drinks in the world. But how many people drinking it know that it was created in India to get the British officers to drink tonic water, which had quinine in it, which stopped them getting malaria. So that's why gin and tonic was created. And so, but here you are drinking it in a bar somewhere or before dinner or wherever. And I think it just adds to your consciousness of what you're doing, understanding the context of where all these things come from.
It is a fun combination of research and history. And I was listening to the champagne episode, and I believe when you drop the name Moët, I'm like, oh, that's where that comes from. Things like that.
Yeah, and that's it's one of those things that the people who made that and the guys from, I think it was that house, they were good friends with Napoleon. Napoleon used to collect a case before he went off to battle. I mean, it's just fascinating stories about how this all came around. The one that I particularly love is Veuve Clicquot, and Veuve means widow in French. And it was the widow of Mr. Clicquot, and she persuaded her father-in-law when her husband died that she would run their champagne house, and she renamed it Widow Clicquot and then took it all over the world and persuaded the Russians, and they kind of fell in love with it, and that's what secured that house, and it's now one of the great champagne houses. But the story of the empowerment of women through and how they kept champagne going is one of the great stories, I think, in food history.
Now, besides champagne, what can you tell us what the other some of the other episodes might be for season 4?
Yep. So we've got, I'm trying to remember now what we've got. I know we've got some great interviews coming up as well. So I did an interview in the first season with a wonderful author. He's actually a medieval professor from Yale, and he wrote a terrific book called 10 Restaurants That Changed America. And
yes.
Yes, and that was, and he's written a new book called American Cuisine, Professor Paul Friedman. So we interview him. I'm trying to think what our other.
You mentioned you think you mentioned caviar that you were writing that.
Well, caviar, I'm writing now. I've just written a two-part episode on the history of curry, which is really fascinating because curry, everyone assumes, is Indian, and India was obviously its birthplace. Was obviously the big bang of you know, kind of. Where curry came from, but what people don't realize, of course, that it's British. You know, curry was created by the British, and so they from when they were in India. So it's a really fascinating thing. It's all about the British discovering spices and bringing it back to Britain, and then to creating curry. So curry powder was created for the British market. The chicken tikka masala is a British invention, not an Indian invention. So it's very fascinating with that. I tell you what else we have, which we've got some interesting ones. We've got one on the history of garlic, which is really fun, because it was primarily used as a medicine, obviously, and then it was considered, which is interesting right now, it was kind of something they used to keep plague away in those days. We've got an episode on pork coming up, so that's about the history of pork, which is obviously fascinating because you have both culturally pork being used and you have the religious side of why some religions choose to exclude pork and why some actually actively use pork. So, you know, obviously two of the Abrahamic religions, Islam and Judaism, exclude pork. And one of the reasons that Christianity included pork was to set themselves off as a point of difference. And so if you go to a place like Spain where pork and ham particularly is like an identifier, it was used when they were occupied by the Moors. The people would secretly eat pork to show that they were Christians. So it was a really fascinating history. Again, we've got one coming on dining in ancient Rome, which is a really fun one because we look at everybody from the aristocrats who ate these extraordinary meals with things like stuffed dormice and all of that, to the gladiators who ate these stews to make them, because the gladiators weren't, we always think of them as being rather muscular, but they're actually quite kind of fat. They wanted layers of fat around them to, that they thought protected them from swords and all kinds of stuff. What else have we got? Oh, the one that we're starting, which we're going to trial and see if people like it, is five things you didn't know came from a city. So we started with our hometown here in LA, and we look at five things that you didn't know started here, things like the Cobb salad, which originated here, or the Moscow mule originated here. And we tell the story of, you know, how those came about. And we tell a little bit about the history of food in LA through the kind of prism of those five dishes, or it could be a drink. So if people like that, then we'll go to other cities and start talking about them as well.
Do you get a lot of requests from listeners and readers?
We do, and we get a lot of questions. So actually, one of the things that we have done for this season that we've recorded is a Q&A episode. So people have asked us a lot of questions about how we put the show together, as you just did. And they ask us about, you know, certain subjects. They ask about, you know, what's the history of X and what's the history of Y. And so we try and answer that. I think we answered about 20 questions in the time that we were allowed to give. Yeah, we were able to give it while we were recording.
Okay.
And then we get a lot of people asking us about certain subjects. And what I have to kind of go away then and figure out in the kind of nicest possible way is, it might be a fun subject, but is there a story there? Is there a history there? You know, someone was asking me the other day, excuse me, about tamarind. And I go, yeah, okay, it's kind of interesting. I'm not sure it's a whole episode interesting. So maybe if I did something about the history of certain spices, then I could fit that in. But I love it when we get requests. And the nice thing is now we're getting not only requests, but we're getting emails from people all over the world now who catch up with it. We had yesterday from an expat American in Kuala Lumpur who had been listening to the show while they were on lockdown in Kuala Lumpur. And they're, you know, listening to the show and were kind enough to send me a note going, we're really enjoying it. So I thought that was really lovely.
Will there be an episode about the history of vodka?
Yeah, I mean, there will. I'm not a great vodka drinker, but there will be one on. I mean, vodka has a fascinating history. And again, I talk about that a little bit when I do the episode for the Moscow Mule, because obviously that's a vodka drink. And vodka was not desperately popular in the U.S. in the early part. And there was a person who bought the license to sell I can't remember which vodka it was at the time, and so he was trying to create a drink. And then there's another guy who bought all these copper mugs, and they were in a bar in LA, and they created this drink, and it became a big hit. And that was the beginning of the Moscow Mule. So I mean, vodka again has some fascinating history, and obviously with its royal history with the Russians, and then it's kind of current history, which is quite interesting because there's a lot of counterfeit going on right now with a lot of people. Russia had this real problem where they were making vodka and selling it through these street stalls that you have. And I've seen it when I've been in Russia. But a lot of it was just like fake wood alcohol, and they had all these people dying and, you know, just falling down on the streets. And it's a really interesting history. There's when you go to St. Petersburg, it's very close, just a short hop across the water from Helsinki. Well, Helsinki being in Europe, everything was much more expensive. So they have these cruises for the day where these Finnish guys will ship across to St. Petersburg for the day. And they buy dozens and dozens of bottles of vodka, and they drink a lot of it while they're there. And you'll often see them like lounging around and lying around in all the parks and stuff. And it's these Finnish kind of booze cruises coming across from Helsinki. It's just a fascinating history, again, all to do with vodka.
Well, I was just actually needling a little bit. I know I've heard you say you're not a fan of it. I wondered if it was it taste or was it an experience?
No, not an experience particularly. I mean, if I'm honest, I mean, gin is basically a juniper-flavored vodka, so at its heart,
okay.
Which it is. I mean, that's basically what gin is. So I'm being a little obtuse about it when I say I don't like it. To me, I would just, it's a preference. I would just much rather drink gin than I would vodka. But having said that, I've had some people give me some vodka to try. There was a place in London that specialized in it from all over the world, and you know, I used to try some of them, and some of them were excellent. So I think a lot of it's just down to preference.
How are you on the rise of flavored spirits?
I'm not a fan. So you know, I think to me, there's a lot of problems with the craft distilling industry. I mean, particularly in the US, there's some terrific ones being made, and I'm lucky enough. Again, I said I'm sitting staring at quite a few really beautifully made craft spirits from the US. But once you start having to flavor your spirits, I think you're basically acknowledging that your base spirit isn't that great. And I always think of that phrase that someone told me in Texas. They said, if you have to put sauce on your barbecue, there's something wrong with your barbecue.
Right.
And I kind of think about it from that. If your base spirit, if you make a great rye or a great bourbon, you make a great rum, you make a great, why do you need to start flavoring it with chili or maple? So I mean, quite frankly, I avoid them like the plague. And it's the same with flavored vodkas. I don't need to drink a raspberry flavored vodka. I don't need to drink even some of the things that people do with gin, there's a lot of people oak aging gin, and that's on the edge. It's fine. But in the end, just make me a really good gin.
Well, nobody's making a birthday cake flavored gin yet.
Well, thank heavens. But people, and look, I think what happens is it's very much that just because you can doesn't mean you should.
Right.
And I think sometimes people just want to do, I think it's true in everything. You see it in cooking, particularly with some of the younger chefs. They want to show everything they know. They're excited about their craft, and they want to do it. And I get why they do it. I'm just not interested in it. You know, I'm much more, if you want to, it's like you want to be excited, go watch Jacques Pepin butcher a chicken on YouTube, and you'll be in awe. And I'd much rather watch that, where he makes one small cut with a knife, and then everything else is just with his hands, than watch someone throw a million ingredients into a pan and kind of try and show off. So I'm all about the economy. So for me, my favorite spirits are things like, you know, a good, like a Beefeater gin, which people think of often as a well drink, but it's actually a beautifully made gin, or a Plymouth gin or something like that. They've been doing it the same way for 250 years, and they're exceptional. But there's nothing clever about them, and I think that's why people sometimes dismiss a lot of these classics. But there is something wonderful about, you know, it's like driving around in a Jaguar. There's something wonderful about it. They're made beautifully. They've been made the same way for X amount of time, or Jaguar probably not so much now because they sold it, but the point is the same. Or Rolls Royce. They're made the same way with the same quality and the same standards for decades and decades, and that impresses me more than someone being clever with something.
Yeah, it's not a question of it if it's in or out of style. It's just always there.
Yeah, and I think sometimes we're too quick to dismiss that because it becomes wallpaper. We we see this sometimes, you know. I know, obviously, we'll talk about movies at a point, but we see this in music, we see it in filmmaking. Sometimes you go and see a movie that's just made by a person who's a complete craftsperson, you know, and they make extraordinary films, but there's nothing about it that's showy. It's just done beautifully.
Mm-hmm.
And when you see those films being done, or you hear a piece of music that's like that, that comes out of a kind of a love of the craft rather than love of show, then I think they tend to have more longevity.
Mm-hmm. Slowly transitioning into movies, I have to tell you, Simon, I really enjoyed seeing the most recent picture you posted of your dad with the wine and the lamb. Well,
God bless him. Well, yeah, he passed away almost a year ago. We were at his funeral back in the UK, so it's still very recent. And then we disappeared last year, we would have been in a distillery in Ireland where we recorded an episode of Eat My Globe about Irish whiskey. So we'd have probably have left there by now, given the time difference. But yeah, he was a man who loved his, food and drink, enjoyed life, lived it very much on his own terms, and was a great kind of mentor for me in the way that he kind of behaved.
What you wrote was, well, he would tell you, because I didn't know he was a retired surgeon, but he would to give you descriptions on how to operate on stuff you were preparing.
Yes, he would. Often hold it up and go, well, this bit is from here. Okay, we really don't need to need that. That's definitely too much information. But he was capable of having a great deal of fun, and got to 86 years, and before he left us, so we had a lot of fun with him.
My father is a retired vascular surgeon.
Oh, so you, yes.
Yeah.
You've had.
So there's that. Well, in my case, it was he would love my dad. He's still with us, but he would we would watch, Chuck Norris or Steven Seagal films. And he would either say things like, oh, I'm glad I don't have to get called in for that, or tell you how to fix it,
Well, my movie memories with my father, and we've talked about this before, but, Saturday, Sunday afternoons watching movies with him, and it would either be the films that I know we've talked about before from the Ealing comedy,
yes,
or Laurel and Hardy, or the other one that we used to watch was a TV show that people have forgotten about now, but to me was one of the greatest. Oh, hello?
Hello? Hello?
Sorry. I think that's another call coming in over you. Sorry, that's okay. I'm fine.
Okay. All right.
But the other one that he used to, I'm sorry, I don't know what that is.
That's all right. Do you want to take it?
No. Absolutely, we're fine. Yeah. There was a show that I think was one of the best sitcoms, probably before people even called them sitcoms, was the Phil Silver Show, Sergeant Bob.
Oh, yes, of course.
And people have forgotten that now. And when I watch it, it's still... I mean, in terms of a comedy performance, it's still one of the greatest ever. And as an individual who totally created that character that was, funny. And I know they rather mistakenly tried to recreate it with Steve Martin, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw that. Yeah.
And it was rather grim, almost as bad as Steve Martin doing the Pink Panther.
yes.
But I still remember watching those from when I was a kid with my father. So I think when you have those memories of them, it's always great fun.
Yeah, my dad, the Marx Brothers, Woody Allen. My dad was the one who introduced me to Monty Python. I know we mentioned that before. When I was I was 19 when the film My Left Foot came out, and it was getting a lot of buzz. And I asked my dad if he wanted to see it, and he just said, "Son, I've been in a hospital all day. I don't really want to sit down and relax to that." But on the flip side, he didn't mind. He didn't mind Steven Seagal breaking some guy's arm in a different direction and not having to take care of that or get called into the emergency room. It's all in the timing, I guess.
Well, it's like people always ask me if I watch a lot of the food programs on TV, whether it's like Ugly Delicious or, you know, all the ones on Netflix, and I just, or Chef, Mind of a Chef, and I just go, I'll see some of them if I'm on a plane or something, but I really don't want to come home after writing about food or talking about food or demoing food all day and sit in front of whoever, however, you know, impressed by them I am. I just really don't want to do it.
Understood. I get that. Okay.
Lots of other things I'd rather do.
Yes. So I guess, Simon, what have you been watching recently, especially in lieu of we have a lot of screening time?
We have. I've been going back and trying to look at some older films that I either I haven't seen or I've forgotten I've seen. So one of the ones that I enjoyed most recently, I think it's a Robert Altman film, was Elliot Gould in The Long Goodbye.
Yes.
Very quirky retake on The Long Goodbye, and I'd forgotten how good it was. And I know this seems ridiculous given that I was, he's been around such a long time. I'd forgotten how good Elliot Gould was in that kind of role. I mean, just as he was in MASH,
yep.
Just as he was. And at that period, early 70s, I thought he was absolutely fantastic, and I loved that. And I then, obviously, like a lot of things, I went to do some research, and they were planning to do a sequel that never happened, and for all kinds of reasons. But it was a really terrific film, and so I've kind of been following that through. And then I've been catching up, obviously, some of the films that have had a lot of awards that they're putting out on streaming now. I saw Knives Out, which I thought was terrific. I thought it was terrifically done. I really enjoyed it, but I couldn't, again, quite real understand why it got such a huge kind of buzz about it. It's very well done, very enjoyable, very watchable. But I was like, okay, now I've seen it. I know when I listen to a lot of the reviews and the film review podcasts I listen to. They're all raving about it, and I was going, I'm not sure I get it, but it was great. Oddly, I felt similar about Parasite. I watched it, and I go, it's really interesting and a bit kind of alarming in some places, but quite why everyone went so nuts over it, it was a surprise to me. I mean, I thought it was well worth watching, and I didn't dislike it in any way. But again, I didn't quite get why it was one that everyone was raving about and winning every award. I mean, I just don't get it. It was obviously, I think, part of the zeitgeist and the timing and whatever else was around at the time. But I mean, I enjoyed it a great deal.
Okay. Yeah, I think it was a film that made my like honorable mention if I were to do a list. But I wondered if it was a good timing. I know the directors had a really nice track record. I can't speak for the voting when it comes to the Academy Awards, but I always use the example with folks of we have a group, the Indiana Film Journalists Association, and one particular year, I think it was last year, our top film was The Hate U Give. It wasn't on anybody's top five, but it was on everybody's ballot. And that's how it got some of that notoriety. So, I wonder if that. As far as Knives Out goes, I think the last, like, giant cast whodunit was Kenneth Branagh's version of Murder on the Orient Express. And I think the fact that it had a little more octane to it is probably what turned folks on. And I think maybe for the mall crowd, it might be one of their first times to a kind of chamber room whodunit.
Yeah, and I think, it's remarkable as well, A, for achieving what it did in terms of awards, but also it before, obviously, we went into this circumstance, it got very good box office, which for something with what I think the director called the kind of one-inch barrier.
Yes.
I think that was pretty remarkable. And so I think it's a milestone in that point of view. I just think as a movie, I enjoyed it a great deal, but it didn't kind of, like people have said, that it had lingered with them afterwards. They thought about it for weeks afterwards. And I didn't with that movie, but the one that actually did is probably one of the favorite things I've seen most recently is Portrait of a Lady on Fire.
Yes. Yep.
which I think is genuinely, apart from cinematography, which is astonishing, because, I mean, and I think this was obviously part of the intention, but almost every scene looks like it is from a still painting of the period.
Yes, you could hang any frame of that film on a wall.
And also the whole intention of the director, her name escapes me right now, but it's all about the power of the female gaze and these lingering shots they do of the two people staring or looking or capturing something through a gaze is really extraordinary. And I think the story is told beautifully primarily through three people interacting, but otherwise, and it's available on Hulu, I believe. So if people haven't seen that, they should really go out and watch it. To me, easily, that's the one that stayed with me for a long time after I watched it. And just because of the kind of gentle, kind of growing nature of this and the fact that it happened over a very short period. And I don't want to give too much away because
sure.
It's a spoiler. But I thought just an exquisite film, just beautifully done, and that stayed with me for a long time afterwards.
Agreed. It was in my top 10. It's a great twist on the connection between the artist and their muse. And Criterion is actually going to put it out on video later this summer. So if you're one of those, if you're one of those that's in the physical copies and the special features and all that, there should be a treasure trove of those for that film. Going back to The Long Goodbye for a little bit, do you recognize locations living in L.A.?
Some of them I absolutely did. I was trying to figure out, and that is one of those. Issues you have some, not issues, one of those kind of things when you're watching a film that's set in a location, you know, whether it's London or New York or LA or, you know, Madrid, towns that I know very well, I'm always going, oh, they're in so-and-so, or particularly when they're in restaurants. There was one, it was a TV show last night, I can't remember which one it was, and they're eating in some restaurant, and I recognized it as one of my favorite steakhouses in LA. And so parts of it, but when you think back, you're talking half a century ago when that film was made. I mean, that's a long time ago, and LA has changed a great deal since then. But but there was an atmosphere to that film that I thought was so special that I really enjoyed watching it. And it was just one of those on Amazon. And one of the things I think of these streaming services, you obviously find their benefits right now. You know, Netflix is obviously more up to date and has more original material. Hulu has its own things. And like I said, Portrait of a Lady on Fire and Parasite were on Hulu, so that was fantastic. Amazon probably doesn't have as much good original material, maybe Bosch and a few other things that I love. But actually, if you go into their archives, they have these old films of things that you'd forgotten existed. And you start watching them, and they've had things like The Long Goodbye. I noticed they had Lady Hawk, which was a Matthew Broderick, Rutger Hauer film.
Michelle Pfeiffer.
Michelle Pfeiffer.
Yeah.
But I haven't seen it I haven't probably seen it since 1981. And I went and watched it. Now, it was probably more kind of nostalgia than anything for cinematic. Dragonheart with Randy Quaid or...
Yep.
They have these things just hidden away in there that you go, oh, wow. So I kind of like doing that and going and finding these films that kind of remind me. They've got what I think is one of the great kind of films for the family ever. And it's dated when you look at it, but it's a beautifully made film called The Amazing Mr. Blunden. Yeah, it was a film made with, I'm trying to remember the actor who was in it. Who played it? Oh my gosh, my mind's gone. But it's set in Victorian times. A family is invited to live in this house where there's been a century before there'd been a fire and children had died, and it's the relationship between the children and the ghosts of the children of the previous thing, and it's beautifully done and it's haunting. And
Lionel Jeffries is the writer and director. Yes.
Yeah, and it's. it's a wonderful film to watch. And I was prompted because a film critic on a podcast in the UK, Mark Commode, spoke about it, and I suddenly realized it was on Amazon, and I went and watched it, and it's just, you know, brilliant. I mean, a little dated because, and also the quality of the print that they were able to take a copy from is probably not as good as it could have been. But really, really worth going to watch.
It's funny you mentioned Lady Hawk, because I remember seeing that in the theater as well. And I don't know how well you know the National Football League, but I'm a lifelong Detroit Lions fan. And I think the connection between the Lions and the Super Bowl, I always say that they're forever cursed like Lady Hawk.
Well, I'm supporting my football club, Rotherham United, who I thought were called Rotherham United nil until I was 15 because it saved time. The only reason I know the Detroit Lions particularly is one of my favorite writers,
George Plimpton.
George Plimpton,
yep,
wrote a wonderful book, Paper Lion.
Paper Lion.
And that's one of my favorites. And I remember reading it and reading about the characters who, played there. And I think it was during the kind of trials and when they used to have to release players. And that's one of the great sporting books. So that's why I remember them.
Switching gears on football, have you seen The Damned United?
I have. It's interesting today to be mentioning that because one of the great players of Leeds United from that period, Norman Hunter, who was well known for being one of the most ruthless, hard tackling, he was known as Norman Bites Your Legs Hunter. He actually passed away this morning from coronavirus, and he was of that period. And he actually ended up managing my hometown team for a while very badly, but he was a great player. And so he was part of that team that rebelled against Brian Clough.
Wow. Now I'm going to have to rent that. I own it. I think that's one of the – that and Amadeus and to a certain degree Othello are three of my favorite stories about jealousy.
Well, they completely – I mean, the character that's obviously that Damned United is, is like the others, is a real person. He was very famous in Britain and famous for being – completely without filter and would tell the truth and is the manager England kind of should have had and was never invited because he upset too many people in high places. And he was and did manage other teams after that to win the European Championship twice and three times, in fact, and was a major, major manager in the old days. But him clashing with Leeds at that period in time, it's like, I don't know what the equivalent would be because I don't understand American sport, but having the most successful team and then bringing in a new manager who suddenly tells them everything they do is wrong was probably not his best move.
I guess it would be like I think Don Zimmer managed the Yankees and the Red Sox, but not to the sinking ship degree that Brian did when he went to Leeds. He wasn't burning his bridges. He was blowing them up like on the River Kwai.
Yeah, he lasted. There was the joke. I think it was a little later, but who lasted less time, him or the Pope? The Pope lasted about
right.
The same time. And yeah, he was gone in 40 days or something, if I remember. I still remember it very vividly.
Mm-hmm. It's funny you mentioned because sometimes I'm going to talk about this on the show in a little bit, but sometimes it takes a death to revisit somebody's work, whether it's an artist or in this case an athlete. But there are two titles I wanted to throw at you because one, the director of a particular film passed away, and an actress from another film passed away. But I thought I've seen some of your film tastes that we in our connections and on social media. Do you know? And I'm going to hopefully not butcher this. Do you know the Japanese director Nobuhiko Obayashi?
Oh, gosh, I might have to be reminded of some of the films off the top of my head.
The one he's best known for is the 1977 thriller House.
I do not know it.
Okay. It's on Criterion. It's a story of a group of schoolgirls going to visit a relative's home in the summer. And on paper, it sounds like, 70s haunted house, teens getting picked off one by one film. the filmmaker is I shouldn't say the person, but the result of the film is absolutely bonkers. low budget effects at that time, and it's more absurd than scary. It's not everybody's cup of tea, but the fact that it's a Midnight movie favorite, and Criterion has put it out, and I revisited it last week, and if you want something that's just visually, I think there are times that even Ken Russell would have said, "Hey, calm down." this might be something that worth checking out.
Oh, that's fantastic.
The other one was there was an actress who later became a director named Hilary Dwyer, later became Hilary Heath. And she wound up being a producer in the 80s. She did the miniseries of Jamaica Inn. She produced An Awfully Big Adventure. She produced Neil by Mouth. But her first film was 1968's The Witchfinder General.
Oh, okay. Yes, yes, yes.
With Vincent Price as the famous witch hunter. You know, not a whole lot for her to do. It's kind of an AIP Hammer film. Those films where, you know, unless you're Ingrid Pitt, the only thing that you're required of is you have as an actress, you have to scream and you have to look great in and out of a corset. But the film is really, really good, at least for Vincent Price's standpoint. He had been parodying himself by the mid-60s, and then the director kind of needled at him to not phone it in, and it became one of his best performances and started a wave of really good Price films like the Dr. Fives films and Theater of Blood.
Well, I think Price, had his moments, and he was also... did you know he released a rather wonderful cookery book as well?
Yes, yes, he loved cooking.
Yeah, no, he released it. It was very successful. I'm a big fan of Hammer films. I mean, they are of their period, but I think they've informed a lot of more recent takes on films. I think they've been picked up as an influence by a lot of anime producers. Mm-hmm. For kind of some of the more horrific anime or horror elements of anime. I mean, I think they're all, when you think they were made for almost no money in Britain over a period of time, particularly when they did the Dennis Weekly ones, The Devil Rides Out or
yep.
To the Devil a Daughter. I mean, they're really well done. They were very clever in the people that they connected to bring into them, people like Peter Cushing and Vincent Price, and they brought them in and they had... Yeah, and they had great fun doing them. And I think Witchfinder General is one of my favorites, and it's a really creepy film. I'm not a great fan of the horror genre at all, normally. I mean, I haven't been able to bring myself to watch Hereditary or...
Oh, okay.
Or Midsommar. It's not usually how I get any kicks about them. They're just... I don't know why. They're not something that I'm particularly interested in, but I think these ones are, I think they've got more of a kind of Saturday night fright fest than anything more sinister.
Yep.
The one that still haunts me years on is the original, not the rather dreadful remake of The Wicker Man.
Yes.
Edward, which is still, to me, one of the most, the ending of that, which they did tried to give a homage to at the end of Midsommar.
Yep.
I think is still one of the most frighteningly chilling things in any film ever. I still think about it.
And it's one of those films, and I think Midsommar and Hereditary owe a debt to the original Wicker Man, is that throughout the film, there's this feeling of just absolute dread. And it's not shock, and it's not blood, and it's, To quote my daughter, the first time she saw Hamlet at a very young age, she goes, "Daddy, this isn't going to end good." And
yeah.
And there's just and it's kind of waiting for the shoe to drop. And I think Witchfinder General has that to a certain degree. I mean, it's they're spoiler alert on a 52-year-old film, but revenge is made, but the damage has been done with everybody involved.
Yeah, absolutely, and. I think those films still hold up, and I still think they're amazing films being made now, and it's hard to to kind of look forward and see which ones of them will still have, you know, legs in that sense, whether it's for horror or for just the majesty of them. And that's why I think Portrait of a Lady on Fire, I think, will be held up as a masterpiece in, you know, if two people start talking together 50 years from now about films,
yep,
they'll hold that up, I think, as a masterpiece. And I think I'm surprised it didn't get more coverage than it did.
Yeah, I think obviously whoever organized the campaign for Parasite did a bang up job and got the results. But I think it was one of those, if people would say if Parasite was not nominated, Portrait would have gotten all that.
There are a lot of things missed out. I mean, the Oscars are by their nature often excluding people. They shouldn't, you know, that Greta Gerwig didn't get a nomination for Little Women. That quite frankly, that. One of my favorite performances of the year was Eddie Murphy in My Name is Dolomite, which I thought was an extraordinary performance.
Agreed. Absolutely.
So I just thought, yeah, but we can sit here and shout about how bad the Oscars are every year. And
right.
Just to fill time.
it's just a time thing. I tell my daughter who's 18, I said, you know, 20, 30 years, you'll find out what people are talking about more. I remember when I was as a college student, I was irate that Goodfellas didn't win Best Picture and it went to, you know, Dances with Wolves. Yeah, I've watched Goodfellas more in the last 30 years. So it's a perspective thing.
Definitely is. I mean, I haven't watched Dances with Wolves, which I enjoyed at the time since I first saw it, you know. So it is one of those that you see, but you don't go back to, whereas Goodfellas. I was surprised at how, if I'm honest, how kind of little The Irishman impacted me in any way. It felt very, and again, it got a lot of praise, but it felt very kind of functional to me.
Hmm.
And maybe it was the kind of de-aging side of it, which I didn't think worked particularly well. Particularly, there's one scene where Robert De Niro's kicking someone outside of the grocery store who's shouted at his daughter or something, I think.
Yep.
But although his face looks young, the rest of the body looks rather rheumatic and aged, and it just kind of all clunked. And I thought it was fine. Again, I didn't understand where it was coming from. It didn't have that impact on me that a number of films have had. But maybe that's just me. This is probably why I end up having arguments with people about Star Wars and stuff, because I have no filters to tell them what I think.
No, that's fine. I enjoyed The Irishman. We were very lucky. We actually got to see a screening of it in an actual theater. So I
suspect that would make a difference.
There is that. The de-aging, you know, first couple minutes, and then I got into it. It kind of reminded me of the Deadeye animation that Robert Zemeckis has done a couple of times with films like Beowulf and Christmas Carol and Polar Express. But there was also a part of me, because Scorsese is my favorite director, and I kept saying to myself and on this show, you know, if you're going to make one more film with De Niro, at least be a stand-up triple or a double. It doesn't have to be the best film of the year. And you know, they made a film together, and that's all I can really ask for. But it is a downer of an ending as well. And I think he wanted, it reminded me that he wanted to, I don't know, kind of put a bow on it, kind of like what Coppola thought he was going to do with Godfather 2.
Yes. I mean, and I did not enjoy it. I just, again, it was one of those where I went, that was fine, but I don't think I ever need to sit and watch The Irishman again.
Understood. Understood.
Pardon me. So, yeah, it's been an interesting year. Obviously, we'll have to wait and see what's coming out. I know they're releasing a lot of things immediately. You know, a lot of things are coming onto the screen earlier now. I saw yesterday there are a number of films that they've just released. Mid-90s, I think, because just Jonah Hill's film has just come onto my screen, so I want to watch that.
It's really good. I saw it on a flight last year.
Yeah. And Eighth Grade, which I haven't had a chance to see yet, which mm-hmm. was another one that I wanted. And then Bait, which I think we've talked about.
Yes.
The one from Cornwall, which is this one where he filmed it silently, and then they record the sound over it, and it's all done on clockwork cameras and wind-up cameras. And was considered by the critic who I kind of have some of the most respect for, Mark Kermode, as his kind of best UK film of the last decade. Mm. So I haven't had a chance to see that because it didn't get a wide response in the US, so I'm waiting to see that.
Yeah. Hey, I wanted to ask you about Ealing Studios. And for those listening, Film Movement Classics have been putting out some of the films from Ealing Studios, like Passport to Pimlico, Titfield, Thunderbolt, Whiskey Galore. I was 13 when the film Local Hero came out, which had a huge impact on me as a kid. And by the way,
one of my favorite films ever.
I absolutely adore it. And Criterion put that out last year, so it's out there. But there was also, as time went on and I got older, there were films like Waking Ned Divine and The Englishman That Went Up a Hill and Came Down a Mountain. Yes. And I started to lump them in my head of the, you know, kind of those little cinematic, quaint UK towns where it's gorgeous, the countryside is gorgeous, and everybody is charming, and you want to move there. It's that effective. Would it be safe to say, Simon, that the Ealing Studio films were kind of the grandfather of those films?
I think it may even have been there were some before that, but Ealing was certainly that kind of showing a British tradition or a traditional look at Britain that perhaps didn't exist in a way. So in Passport to Pimlico, they show a side of London where it's all very Cockney and everyone's kind of, you know, has a sing-song in the pub and they, you know, they all get on and they have a little bit of a fight now and again, but, you know, everything's good in the end, which is a kind of view of Britain. Certainly when you look at Local Hero, which is much later. But Bill Forsyth, I actually think if you haven't seen his film that he made before that, which is called That Sinking Feeling, which is a wonderful film, which is set in kind of a rough part of Glasgow, I believe, if I haven't seen it for many years. And it's about them stealing kitchen sinks and trying to sell them. It's a really fun one. I've got a few of the people who then appeared in Local Hero. Or there was a film called Gregory's Girl.
Gregory's Girl.
That same kind of period.
Yep.
I think there's an element of films that we make in Britain that have that what we call now the Full Monty kind of approach, where it's a group of kind of misfits from a part of England getting on with something. And there's been a number of them since. There was Calendar Girls that they did with the kind of seniors doing this naked calendar. There was another one recently called Military Wives that just came out that has got, I'm trying to think who's in that now, Laura Mandel, I think, is in it, which is the same about a choir. There was Brassed Off, which I actually think is a good one.
Yep.
And it's a way of looking at Britain. It's a way of looking at the class divide in Britain. It's a way of looking at, how Britain is changing. And I think they're rather interesting films. But another perfect one, although it's set outside of the UK, is Best Marigold Hotel. And that's really all about that, even though it's set in India, and that's really all about being British and growing old.
yes.
And the difference. And so that's very much a part of that, because what they are really is kind of expats. And so it's all about their little bit of Britain that they're trying to recreate in the Best Marigold Hotel. And you'll see it in more things that are trying to be a bit more contemporary. So there's one that came out that's just gone on streaming called Blinded by the Light, which is all about someone growing up in the 70s in Britain under the kind of curse of the racism that was around at the time, still is around, but was kind of and grew up in an Indian family, but was guided by their love of Bruce Springsteen. So, I mean, they're all of these films all come out, I think, out of that root of Ealing and this. And some of them, I think, people forget that things like Kind Hearts and Coronets, Man in the White Suit, they're actually, some of them were quite dark as well.
Mm-hmm.
They were very dark. And they had magnificent performances. The two there, Kind Hearts and Coronets, and Man in the White Suit had two of the greatest performances, I think, in British filmmaking, which were from Alec Guinness.
Yes, that's when you have Alec Guinness with you, that's not bad.
Yeah, I mean, he was, and again, I think people forget and they think about Alec Guinness because of him as Obi-Wan or whatever. but they forget his history. I mean, just extraordinary capacity as an actor to do. I think in Kind Hearts and Coronets, he played 7 or 8 roles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, yeah, we forget just how wonderful he was. So, you know, I think if noise outside.
That's all right.
I think people should go back and watch those films. And things like The Lady Killers, which was obviously remade later with Tom Hanks.
Yeah.
They're well worth going to watch. Well worth going to watch.
Yeah. So as I mentioned, listeners, it's Film Movement Classics. They've released Whiskey Galore, Passport to Pimlico, and Titfell Thunderbolt, and as well as Gregory's Girl. I got that on Blu-ray earlier this year and had never seen it and thoroughly enjoyed it. Little slice of life.
Well, it sums up that period. I'm probably exactly the same age, I think, as I forgot the actor's name now. He's still... appears in quite a lot of things in the UK. But it's just that kind of whole romance thing that's going on, particularly when you're at that stage, and it's all very... I think what happens in British films is the protagonists tend to be kind of a little bit more loserish than they tend to be in some of the US ones. I always think Gregory's Girl is almost like the anti-Ferris Bueller in many ways. If Ferris Bueller is like the hip and happening and in charge and knows what's going on and is very much an expression of the American side of things, whereas Gregory's Girls is a complete kind of loser and can't get on with anything. And I think in a way it kind of sums up, if you look at British comedy tends to be people like Basil Fawlty who are just idiots, whereas American comedy tends to be Seinfeld who are like heroes and always come out on the top.
But it's funny you mentioned earlier 8th Grade, which I absolutely love. And there I've told my daughter that they're the current last few years of teenage films. I was not, even though I was the target audience, I think the films of John Hughes from the 80s are a tad overrated. And now part of it was I had experienced the Outsiders and Rumblefish before seeing the John Hughes films, and that kind of demystified the suburban fairy tales of Mr. Hughes's work. But in the last few years, films like 8th Grade, Booksmart, Edge of 17, where they don't seem like suburban cartoon characters. They're, you know, these are insecure people trying to survive high school, which is, you know, can be just as treacherous as any other workforce.
Well, Booksmart was definitely my favorite film of last year by far. I enjoyed it enormously and have watched it 2 or 3 times now. And I think that it primarily because the performances of everyone, not just the two leads who are obviously terrific,
mm-hmm.
but the performances of everyone throughout were very honest and it was funny and it was just beautifully put together. And there was obviously a great deal of Olivia Wilde's kind of direction was sensitive. And the other one that I thought was very good came out of that, and it didn't get much coverage, but I think it was a really underrated one of that as a high school kind of, was Love, Simon.
Yes, yes, you're right.
And I think it was, I think it did okay. I think, I know that they're making a TV series out of it, I believe. So whether that'll be successful or not, time will tell. But it was one that I enjoyed a great deal.
Mm-hmm. Shifting gears a little bit. So what was the last date night movie you had with your wife?
Well, we don't get much chance to go out to the movies. Well,
I would say inside, I guess.
Well, inside was probably Parasite. We did go out. The last time we actually got a chance, and we were very late in the day when we went to see it because we've been traveling a lot, we went to see the rather disastrous Rise of Skywalker, which I thought, I mean, the only benefit of that film is it proves that Jar Jar Binks wasn't the worst thing to ever happen to Star Wars. I thought it was shocking, I have to say. I thought it was risibly awful. And I was, I'm not, you know, the biggest Star Wars fan in the world. I'd much rather watch a Star Trek or something. But I thought that The Last Jedi was actually rather good. and Rise of Skywalker, I thought was equally bad, and basically took away all the good bits out of the middle film, and ended up with some kind of, it looked like it had been written by some kind of 13-year-old who fan fiction person.
Oof.
I thought it was dreadful. Now I'm gonna get lots of hate.
No, that'll be fine. How about, all right, so I'll give this an example. There are certain films that we both like that you know your spouse is not going to want anything to do with. Do you remember the last time you had one of those?
Oh my God! Probably The Long Goodbye.
That
would definitely be it, I think. And I think sometimes a lot of it's with those that with those older films. You have to first get over the quality of the prints that they use, which are often very poor. And so you kind of have to work your way through those. So sometimes you're seeing everything through a fog of, you know, 1970s kind of whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you can't concentrate and can't get it. And also the storytelling is often so the ways that stories were told then are so different to the ways that you have to tell a story now, because they could build up more slowly, they could have a long form of telling that tale, and people don't do that now because they want to be kind of rewarded a bit more quickly. And so I noticed that when I was watching All the President's Men for the umpteenth time the other day, and I was just thinking that it's still a wonderful film. I still think, you know, of that ilk, of that type of film that they kind of followed on with. I'm trying to remember the one they did about Boston and about the Catholic Church.
Spotlight.
Spotlight.
Yep.
But and there's another one, The Post, is a similar one. And I think they're noticeably different in the pace that they have to run. Whereas in All the President's Men, it felt like a kind of gentle jog along,
right?
And you really got into it, and it was like a long novel, and really getting involved in it, which I thought with Spotlight you couldn't do that. It had to run along at a pacier kind of clip.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's just especially, and I now I feel like I'm on the front porch with looking at the kids, but there's a certain pacing element that you take the time to let the story unfold. I remember showing my peers, we were in college, and I remember trying to show them The Exorcist, and they had been trained that, you know, there's blood within the first 5-10 minutes, and, you know, nothing really kicks in until 45 minutes into that film.
Absolutely. And yes, I think you wouldn't get away with that now, but I think that's, you know, Friedkin as well, being a little obtuse and just being
yes.
what he wanted. And if you've got someone like that who really doesn't care what, you know, producers and everybody else think about them, they're still going to do something really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'll give an example of something that I can only watch by myself, and this is my lovely wife is very patient with me. I know the last time we spoke, we spoke briefly about the films of Ken Russell, who I
yes.
absolutely adore. The man was a lunatic. I didn't have to live with him, but I got to see his product. One night, I had purchased the Blu-ray of Tommy, and anytime I can get my wife to look up from her laptop, or in this case, she walked through the room and stopped, and it was the famous Anne Margaret scene.
Oh yeah.
Now, those who don't know Tommy, there's a scene with Anne Margaret, champagne, chocolate, and baked beans, and it's Ken Russell. So I'm just going to leave it at that. but my wife walks in, stops, watches this scene, and then leans over to me and says, "She got nominated for this?" And I said, "Yes." And she went, "Slow year," and left the room. That's my lovely sitcom wife. So about two weeks later, it's late at night. She's up in her bedroom. I'm down in the TV room, and I'm channel surfing the movie channels, and Tommy is on. And I flip to it, and it's 10 minutes before that scene. And because I'm a terrible sitcom husband, I watch it again. And then she pops her head in, "Are you watching that again?" And I said, "It's on TV. I didn't put a disc in." And I used the term sitcom wife look. She just looked at me, shook her head, and went back in the room.
Well, it is. I mean, Tommy's one of those things that I haven't seen it in its entirety for years. Usually what happens is I'll start watching it and then stop watching it and watch a bit, I think it, sometimes just watch clips of it. I'll watch, you know, Wicked Uncle Ernie, or I'll go and watch, you know, all of the bits that I particularly love and then stop. And I often think it's not worth watching the whole way through. It's just too much for me.
Well, and also because since it's based on the album, you could go to song by song and say, okay, I just want to hear this or I see that.
And funnily enough, I was watching last night for a short period, Kids Are All Right.
Yeah.
So. And which has got Ken Russell, and it's got interviews, and it's got, you know, them in performance at various points in their career, and you know, it was one of those. And I remember going to see that at the cinema with as a double bill with Quadrophenia.
Oh, geez.
So that's a long time ago. That's in the late 70s.
Nice. I have a number of Russell's films. I have a weird perversion pleasure over Listomania. And even something like, well, and going back with Women in Love, which on paper looks like a masterpiece theater production, except for the wrestling scene and a couple other scenes, but most notably the wrestling scene. So,
yes, the wrestling scene has become infamous.
Yeah, better, and I guess better than us, as are out there. All right. So just a reminder, folks, you can check out Eat My Globe at eatmyglobe.com as well as samaymajumdar.com. What else would you like to plug, Simon, while I got you here?
No, nothing really. It just, you know, if people have any kind of things spare and they want to support their local restaurants with takeout or by buying gift cards that they can use later to help restaurants get through this business, and the same, obviously, the people who listen are obviously going to be fans of cinema. A lot of those do theater cards. Your independent cinemas are really going to be struggling right now, and they're looking to help their staff. Just try and do something like that. Or the other thing, you know, let's just take the opportunity to say thank you to everyone who's working on the front line, whether it's in the healthcare or they're in the grocery stores or they're delivering. All these people who are going out there and having to face stuff while we sit inside and talk about movies for an hour or so. You know, let's just try and do that. And then when it's all done, let's go out and enjoy ourselves and see some great films again.
There you have it, my epic chat with Simon Majumdar. Go to simonmajumdar.com or you can go to eatmyglobe.com for all information. Good stuff there, and it's always good to have Simon on the show. All right, grab a pencil if you haven't already. I'll go through what I've watched first. Now, yes, what we try to do at the Soci household is we have a lot of solo time at the house, and then hopefully as a family get together, have dinner, and watch the television. And I know we've been rotating series-wise between The Good Place, BoJack Horseman, and Russian Doll. You're welcome, Emma. And then whatever we can from time to time. So I was on the air last Saturday night, and as I mentioned in the chat with Simon, two films I wound up watching because there were deaths in the film world. And by the time I get home on Saturday nights after being live here at WFYI with the house party, I had set up that I wanted to do a midnight movie. Now, it turned out to be 11:30, but I wanted to do a midnight movie on a Saturday night. And with the death of Nobuhiko Obayashi, the director of the 1977 Japanese horror comedy House, I revisited it. And as I said with Simon, if you want something that's just bonkers and it is scary, but it's also very silly, and it hits the right tone of both. And it's on Criterion, so I would say go check that out. And it fit perfectly into winding down after a day of work, an evening of work, and being able to sleep in on Sunday. For Easter Sunday, at Emma's request, well, we had an Easter ham, but we also watched Ponyo, because Ponyo loves ham, and Ponyo loves Sosuke. So a little Studio Ghibli Miyazaki work on Easter Sunday. I mentioned before, Hilary Dwyer, the actress, and also Hilary Heath, who was her first feature film was the Vincent Price film from 1968, Witchfinder General, which I highly recommend. It's also a film I discovered through the Danny Peary cult film books. This was in his first volume of write-ups about cult movies. I finished Treasure of the Sierra Madre, one of the best films about greed, and I'm that guy that goes through the bonus features and the commentary tracks. And there's also a really cool two-hour documentary about John Huston, hosted by Robert Mitchum and some very famous talking heads talking about his life and career, and cool archival footage of Huston being interviewed as well as on location. And then my wife and I watched the National Theater Live production of Jane Eyre, which I don't think I'd ever seen on stage. I have seen a couple film versions. I remember seeing the Franco Zeffirelli film version from the 90s in the theater, starring William Hurt. Really cool tale with minimalist telling of the tale. Minimalist sets, set pieces. It's a lot of wood and planks and ramps and metal ladders, and that's it. Really solid performances from everybody, but it's not the giant, lush kind of masterpiece theater. Kobe and I would – this would be something that Fair Sweet Bianca would want to watch with her mother, not so much with Kobe. If you're longtime listeners of the show, you know what I'm talking about. But it's a lovely take on the story, on the Bronte story, and especially – The first act runs 2 hours. The show is almost 3 hours, folks, but the transitions really are really smooth, and it moves along at a nice pace, especially in Act One. I don't think you'll feel tired after watching Act One. It is an epic story, but with minimal sets and a really good ensemble. So anyway, and of course, there's a slew of stage performances happening streaming, you know, because sometimes the show turns into stage sociology, as you know. Once again, before grabbing a pencil, and sometimes it's, as I mentioned, sometimes it takes a death of an artist to go and revisit their work. And I owe Timothy Brown an apology. I forgot to mention him on the show last week. A football player turned actor, born in Richmond, Indiana. Now, according to his IMDb, in Knightstown, Indiana. But he also wound up playing football at my alma mater, the Ball State University, and then went to the pros, and like a lot of players at that time in the 60s, turned to acting when their career was over. He appeared as Captain Corporal Judson in Robert Altman's film version of MASH, and then later appeared as Captain Jones, you know, S.C. Jones. You know the character I'm talking about. Fred Williamson played Captain Jones in the Altman film version of MASH. Timothy Brown got to play him in the TV version. Are we square here? Okay. Some other films of note that Timothy Brown appeared in: Sweet Sugar and Bonnie's Kids from 1972, as well as A Place Called Today, Black Gun. I enjoyed the Jim Brown action film with evil Martin Landau. Also appeared in Girls Are for Loving from 1973, The Dynamite Brothers, 1974, played Tommy Brown in Robert Altman's Nashville in 1975. I need to revisit that. Emma has actually been voicing interest in checking out Nashville. The Zebra Force and Black Heat from 1976, as well as Disney's Gus. Yeah. Also Pacific Inferno with Jim Brown. Played the assistant coach in Losing It from 1983. Did a bunch of TV, and then his last couple films include Midnight Ride from 1990 and Frequency from 2000. So thank you, Timothy Brown. Also passing away is, and I'm going to butcher it and I'm sorry, but it's cinematographer Alan DeVoe, who best known, he got received 5 Academy Award nominations for his cinematography for E.T., The Color Purple, Empire of the Sun, Avalon, and Bugsy. Yeah, not bad. Other credits include The Brothers O'Toole, Mother Tiger, Mother Tiger. He did The Boy Who Drank Too Much, Rage, Falcon and the Snowman from 1985. I mentioned E.T., of course. Empire of the Sun, I'd mentioned, Defending Your Life, Fearless, Congo, the astronaut's wife, and a few others. So salute to Alan DeVoe there. And Danny Goldman. Now, Danny Goldman is a that guy. You've seen him as a kind of a bespeckled, sort of nebbish character. Was the voice of Brainy Smurf in the Smurf animated series. Was Corporal Murat in Robert Altman's MASH. He was in The Strawberry Statement. Was in Beware the Blobbed. Yes, the one directed by Larry Hagman. Simon brought up The Long Goodbye. He had an uncredited cameo in that as the bartender. But he was and Busting as well as the film Why. But he is the medical student who grills Gene Wilder at the beginning of Young Frankenstein back in 1974. Also appeared in films like Tunnel Vision and The Missouri Breaks and Where the Buffalo Roam and Holy Moses. So salute to Danny Goldman. And of course, as we found out the day before this filming of actor Brian Dennehy, just a powerhouse actor, did a handful of TV series in the 70s before appearing in his first two films, Looking for Mr. Goodbar and Burt Reynolds' Semi-Tough from 1977. He's the guy who chews glass and was hanging a girl off a roof. Appeared in Sylvester Stallone's film Fist, as well as Foul Play, Butch and Sundance, the early days. Little Miss Marker. Thing he got really noticed for right away was playing the hostile sheriff in the Sylvester Stallone film First Blood, and wound up playing some heavies in films like Never Cry Wolf, Gorky Park, and then of course the corrupt sheriff in Lawrence Kasdan's Silverado. Chris Lloyd, that one's for you. I love that film as well. But he also, so because of his size, I believe he was 6'3", and his shape and his demeanor, a lot of intimidating characters. And then he had a lovely turn as the head of the group in his character's name was Walter in Ron Howard's Cocoon in 1985. Films like FX, Bestseller, Return to the Snowy River, Last of the Finest, yes, there was FX too, Gladiator, no, not that one, and so known for mostly dramas and then doing occasional comedy. Of course, he was Chris Farley's dad in Tommy Boy, was Ted Montague in Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet, and kept working right up until... My goodness, I'm scrolling up. And yeah, I still had production credits in 2020. He was on The Blacklist. My daughter knows him from the voice of Remy's dad in Ratatouille. He also played Soren in the 2018 film version of The Seagull. And patting myself on the back department, I got to see him portray Willie Loman in the Goodman Theater's production of Death of a Salesman in the late 90s. And I saw him beforehand. I got to the theater too early. I basically took the train from my newspaper job to the Goodman Theater in downtown Chicago and was hanging out in the lobby. And this is 20-some-odd years ago. I mean, he was big then and was walking with a cane. And I from a distance, just said hello. And he kind of grunted back and didn't stop. And all with the cane and the slow walking, I'd not seen that when I saw him in interviews, and obviously you don't see that in the film, but seeing him on stage, you saw none of that. This production of Death of a Salesman had a rotating stage. That way it made the set scene changes a lot smoother. And seeing him moving on and off this spinning set, and of course, obviously in performance mode, it was one of the best stage performances I've ever seen in my life. And I have a soft spot for Death of a Salesman. It was the first play I was in that wasn't involving school. Anyway, it's something that always stuck with me. So thank you, Brian Dennehy. You know, there's a slew of things that people will remember him for, whether it is First Blood or Silverado or Ratatouille. I was one of the rare few to be able to see him in Death of a Salesman. And I believe Lou Harry also mentioned he saw him in Long Day's Journey and Tonight, and Long Day's Journey in Tonight, and then Twelfth Night up in Stratford, Ontario. So salute, Brian. All right, grab a pencil. Let's see what you've been watching. We go to... Oh, by the way, you're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. And we start with my buddy Eric, who likes to send me these via email, because he's working, and that's all right. He has a few different categories. His first time viewing the original 1950 Night in the City. Yes, the one with Richard Widmark. The remake with De Niro is not bad. He calls it good stuff. Carmen Jones from 1954, the Otto Preminger production of the musical. He called it fair to middling. And Hustlers from 2019, of course, Jennifer Lopez from last year, Constance Wu, really, really good film. He rewatched the original 1972 Sam Peckinpah film, The Getaway. Good call there. TCM Watch, the channel offers the shut-in smorgasbord, of course, from Preminger's magnificent noir mystery, Laura, from 1944, to the Fred Astaire Ginger Rogers collection, and their quarterly showing of Casablanca, which is apparently happening Saturday evening. So thank you, Eric. Moving on to your list, Catherine writes, sorry, it's been a lot of DIY, HDTV, and cooking channel with the parents. Tell Joanna and Nigella I said hello. Jared writes, Austin Powers, Saving Mr. Banks, and Big Jake. Nice collection there. Hoover, or Andrew, writes, Gangs of New York, the Brendan Fraser version of The Mummy, Straight Outta Compton. Patty writes, His Kind of Woman from 1951, So's Your Aunt Emma from 1942, and started the Star Wars movies in chronological order. These are the times we live in, folks. Sarah writes, Onward, all caps with an exclamation point. Jackie writes, Cabin in the Woods, Return of the Jedi, Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Tammy writes, Banana Split, Set It Up, and I watched part of Lawless again because Tom Hardy is a hillbilly. And then she wrote, Swoons. That's something I write online quite a bit. Megan writes, Roman Holiday, and I'm so sad I waited so long to see it. Megan, better late than never. That's the beauty of art. So it's new to you. So I'm glad you got to finally experience Roman Holiday. Get on a Vespa with Audrey and or Greg. Doesn't matter. Jed writes, 10-31-16, parts 1 and 2. Evan Dossi, I finished the non-mystery science theater versions of the Gamera films. And Allie and I also started our Star Wars watch through, going episode 1, 2, etc. All right. Spencer writes, The Amazing Jonathan documentary on Hulu is an extraordinarily uncomfortable thing to watch and totally worth it. I've been meaning to get into that, Spencer. I will try to check that out. Christian writes, Troop Zero. Sarah writes, What's Up, Doc? And Onward. Molly writes, Jumanji, The Next Level, the 2019 Little Women, On the Basis of Sex, and Bedknobs and Broomsticks. Maybe in that order. Lou Harry writes, Jane Eyre Stream and Arkansas. Spencer chimes in again, Watch Galaxy of Terror, 81, cash in on Ridley Scott's Alien that is star-studded by Corman standards and a fantastic window in the Corman School of Filmmaking. And I believe Roger Corman wants to see your quarantine films. Go online, do a search, but he apparently is accepting submissions for a kind of a quarantine film festival. But check into that. Monica Hart, she's been on the show, introduced Brian to Bridget Jones's Diary. Brian Hart, who's also been on the show, not the biggest rom-com fan in the world. I see what Monica is doing there, as well as BB and I watched Labyrinth. You're doing good work there, Monica. Laura writes Godfather 1 and 2, Jersey Boys, Places in the Heart, all three Hunger Games, two films, one book, whatever, and Silver Linings Playbook. Daniel writes, Stage Fright, The Parent Trap, and All About Eve again. I Am Not a Witch, a movie set in Zambia and Ghana. I've seen that, Daniel. It's very good. I Wake Up Screaming, Libeled Lady, The Lighthouse, Just Mercy, which just came out on video this week, Splash, Swing High, Swing Low, Evil Under the Sun, The Mirror Cracked, War and Peace, and All of Me. Thank you, Daniel. Kim writes, Uncut Gems, one of the most disturbing and unsettling movies I've watched in a long time. I like to call it, Kim, I like to call it film noir on Red Bull, and actually a really good performance from Adam Sandler. Teresa writes, Pretty in Pink, The Breakfast Club, and 16 Candles, the Molly Ringwald trilogy. Yes. Bonnie writes, yesterday was fantastic and Booksmart was incredible. Paper Moon never disappoints. Nick writes, Nick Rogers, who's been on this show, Paul Schrader's Cat People, The Decline, the Netflix survivalist thriller, and Triple X State of the Union. He wrote Criterion Collection Edition. Smart guy. Allison writes, I watched a bunch of Hulu recommended lesser known films, Radio Flash, Before I Go to Sleep, and Destroyer. And then she writes, Nicole kind of deserves an Oscar for Destroyer, by the way. She is very good in that. If you'd have told me Nicole Kidman was going to play a burnt out L.A. cop, I wouldn't have believed it. But she's very good in that. Maria writes, tonight, Spaceballs. All right. Julie writes, watching the 1954 Star is Born with Judy Garland, of course. Kathy writes, Hidden Figures with my 94-year-old mom who hadn't seen it before. Way to go, Kathy. And way to go, Kathy's mom. Britt writes, the French 2014 version of Beauty and the Beast, Angel Has Fallen, American Ultra, Tootsie, Secondhand Lions, Salt, Burlesque, Kate and Leopold, The Family, Shakespeare in Love, Elizabeth, The Holiday, and Elizabeth the Golden Age. John writes, Alice in Wonderland, the Trolls World Tour, and John did The Wizard of Oz with audio replaced by Dark Side of the Moon. You know what? That's the first one that is, John, way to go. That's the first one that has been sent, that I've heard has done that since we've had this pandemic in our lives. So maybe there will be a boost in that. Bob writes, I'm going for an Australian double feature, Muriel's Wedding and Strictly Ballroom. JJ writes, Reality Bites, Rogue One, Maltese Falcon, Searching for Sugar Man. Robert writes, Paper Moon and Laura. Mike on my Facebook page wrote, Introducing my son tonight. And then he has a picture of Alex Karras's Mongo, which means he's showing his son Blazing Saddles. Good father-son time there. Frank writes, Jojo Rabbit, well-written, well-played, and film well. However, the darkness of the subject matter and numerous plot elements in the film really shade the comedy. You're right, Frank. We bantered about that. Scott and Kim Wright went back to my Michigan roots and watched all the Evil Dead movies. All right. Roxana writes, I got sucked into Big Little Lies, just finished season one. Meryl is in season two. Correct. Linda writes, we rented Little Women, Jojo Rabbit, and 1917. Lisa writes, Mildred Pierce, Snatch, Pulp Fiction. David writes, I watched The Other Guys and Kingpin, plus I had Blade Runner assigned in my film lit class, so I watched it to keep up with my yearly viewing on it. Very good, David. Mary writes, Super 8, which is on my Blu-ray pile. I need to get to that. Mark Jubeck's been on the show. Only the Lonely, the John Candy film, 16 Candles, and Unbreakable. Drew writes, the Criterion release of Polyester. Yes, Criterion can release all of John Waters' films the early ones. I know they are working on those. Alan writes, The Florida Project and Ride the Pink Horse. Gretchen writes, The Natural and Hitchcock's Rear Window and Vertigo. Anne writes, The Platform. Andrew writes, The First Four James Bond Films and Meatballs. Good combo. Claire writes, Claire last week said she watched Parasite, and I told her to watch the other Bong Joon-ho films. So we watched Mother, and I've been deep diving into K-dramas, Korean dramas. Time to learn me some Korean. Yes, thank you, Claire. Michelle writes, Onward. It was cute. With an exclamation point. Mandolin writes, Blow the Man Down on Prime. It was good. Kayla writes, Pitch Perfect 3, John Wick 3, and Deadpool. What a combo. Yes, it is, Kayla. You should watch Phantom on streaming. Diana writes, Coherence, The Wilding, 222. Did I already say High Rise? Started Ozark, and all I can say is WTF. I gotcha. Cheryl writes, this week, Step Brothers, and the last couple weeks were Portrait of a Lady on Fire, Heat, and The Social Network. I've been watching some movies featured on the Ringers Rewatchables podcast. Very good, Cheryl. Devin writes, Big Hero 6, Genius, and Inside Out. Daniel writes, The Birdcage. Chloe writes, Swiss Army Man, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and then in parentheses, meh. Splash, my all-time favorite movie as a kid and the first time watching it as an adult. Green Room, Banana Split, 2018, and the National Theater Live performance of Fleabag. We did watch that last week as well. So Emma's a big fan of the – well, we are all fans of the series, but Emma is the one who brought Fleabag into our house, and we're all the better for it. Tom writes, ready or not. Connor writes, Leon the Professional. I'm assuming that's the original, not the remake. Howl's Moving Castle and A Knight's Tale. Janet writes, Good Will Hunting, Play Misty for Me, Lovelace, Across 110th Street. Great. They Call Me Mr. Tibbs, Letters to Juliet, The Natural, and The Horse Whisperer. Kaylin writes, The Librarian, Search for the Spear of Destiny, Star Wars, Rise of Skywalker, Kung Fu Panda, Finding Nemo, The Fork, and Female Sexuality, The Never-Ending Orgasm. That's the title, folks. Diana chimed in, this is one time I would endorse the use of semicolons when we write our lists, because right now I really wanted to watch a movie called Finding Nemo, The Fork, and Female Sexuality. I love people on social media. Brian writes, watch Toy Story 4, which I believe is written to make grown men cry. I'm still, I got choked up on Toy Story 4. I did cry in 3, but not nearly as much as I cried in 2. It's the Jesse song, you know it. Dustin writes, the jazz singer from 1927, Saving Private Ryan, and Juno. Jeff writes, 21 Jump Street. Devin writes, live performances of Bandstand on Playbill and Jane Eyre. Both were wonderful. Jane Eyre was spectacular. I agree. Lucinda writes, The Talented Mr. Ripley, The Robe, and Prince of Egypt. Robin writes, not Robin Wright, Robin, Robin chimes in, Stuart Saves His Family, an underappreciated super gem. Hits all the notes on life with a dysfunctional family, all the truly laugh-out-loud, funny, poignant, and difficult. Surprisingly, a near-perfect movie, even if SNL's Stuart Smalley drove you crazy. Thank you, Robin. Eric writes, I know it's not film, but Alan Arkin and Michael Douglas in the Kaminsky Method has been magical for me this week. Damn that Chuck Lorre. Watched What's He Eating Gilbert Grape and couldn't not watch The Wedding Singer. Nikki writes, Shazam, Die Hard, and Onward. And there we go. And, of course, David asks, when does this air? So it's, of course, WFYI.org/listen. So there's your, there you go, folks. There's hope you have found some titles. I hope during this time when we're at home, obviously, we want films that we know will bring us satisfaction and will bring us pleasure and it will bring us some escape in these times. But I also say for every one of those, if you can, do a film, try a film you haven't experienced yet. This is the time to do that. There shouldn't be anybody saying, I've run out of things to watch or there's nothing to watch. Take a chance and try something out there. All right, ladies and gentlemen, some words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's plenty out there if you keep digging, and we'll try again next week. Stay healthy, stay sane, and be good to one another on and off the internet. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
Okay. We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!